Well, keep in mind, AJ, who you saw there in that video, he doesn't believe in God, and he, although he tried to live a year to quote unquote live biblically, he clearly hasn't read the Bible. Because if you watch the whole thing and you see his conclusions, he is still has none the wiser as to what really to do with all of the Old Testament commands. It was sort of for him a project to be able to write a book and sort of, I don't want to say poke fun at, but that's kind of what ends up happening, poke fun at anybody who would take the Bible quote unquote literally, which that's its own broad term. And it still kind of brings up the question, though, for you and for me, what do we do with these 613 laws from the Old Testament? What do we do with them? How do they apply to us as Christians? That's a question that's come up quite a bit over time, and people often ask me that. And it's not an easy answer, to be honest with you. But we do need to at least go through, and there are several passages in the Bible which give us the answer to this. Ones that I'm sure AJ has never read, because if he's read them, he would have been able to answer the question as to whether or not we should be living biblically, as he would say it, from the Old Testament. The first, though, is we'll look over in Hebrews chapter 8, verse 13. Remember, very first week, I said, if you want to understand Leviticus, there's a lot of New Testament passages, especially out of the book of Hebrews. Hebrews really explains to us Leviticus. And in Hebrews chapter 8, at the very end of it, he kind of summarizes everything up, and he says, by calling this covenant new, and this is a quote from the book of Jeremiah chapter 31, that almost all of chapter 8 of Hebrews is a quote from Jeremiah 31, where he's talking about this new covenant. So we are in the New Testament times, we are under the new covenant, and it's a time where it's looking forward to the new covenant that we will live in as Christians, which we're now living in right now. So he says, by calling this covenant new, Jesus made the first one obsolete. And what is obsolete or outdated will soon disappear. Now, obsolete doesn't mean that it negates it, it's no longer valid. It just means that it doesn't have any usefulness anymore. It's sort of like I sort of left off last week. When you have a picture of somebody that you're in love with, once they show up, the picture is kind of useless. You don't really need the picture when they're standing right there. And so when he says that the law was made obsolete, it didn't have the same usefulness that it had before. It wasn't of any, it didn't have the same value that it did before, if you will. So follow me with me as we go through this and kind of understand. The second passage I want to make sure we kind of hang what we're looking at on is over in Acts chapter 15, verse 19. All of Acts chapter 15 is sort of a summary of this question the early church had. And in the early church, you had a population that was predominantly Jewish who followed all of these 613 laws. But then you had new people coming to a relationship with Jesus Christ who didn't have a Jewish background, who didn't know anything about these 613 laws. And so the question then came out is, we Jews, we like our way of living, and we like our sort of culture. This is part of our ingrained culture and understanding, and we want to continue to follow a lot of these guidelines from the Old Testament as we have a relationship with Jesus within reason. But what about the Gentiles, these people who didn't grow up Jewish? Do they have to do all these same things that we're doing? Do they have to follow all 613 of the Old Testament commands in order to have a relationship with Jesus? And sort of an easy summary of Acts chapter 15 is they come out and they say, no, they don't. No, they don't have to follow these 613 laws of the Old Testament. And it's summarized up with this phrase in Acts 15, 19. It says, it's my judgment, therefore, that we shouldn't make it difficult for the Gentiles who are turning to God to have a relationship with him. The picture is, it's really difficult to follow all of these things. It's very burdensome, and we shouldn't put that burden on new believers. But then he goes on and says, you know, but in order for you guys to get along, there's a couple of things that Gentiles could do just to make things easier between the two of you. And sort of follows a guideline that you see Paul use in 1 Corinthians 9, where he says, you know, for the sake of winning people and not creating controversy, sometimes I do some things just to sort of keep the peace. You can look that up on your own time later. So when it says that the Old Testament laws are obsolete, I want to kind of look into why that is and what does that mean exactly. And so to do that, I'm going to use sort of a rough framework. When people look through the book of Leviticus, there's sort of three general categories that the laws fall into when you're looking through the Old Testament. And there's some flaws with this summary, but we'll go through that. The first group is what are often referred to as ceremonial laws. And this is described over in Leviticus chapter 10, verses 10 to 11. It says, you're to distinguish between the holy and the common, between the ceremonially unclean and the ceremonially clean. You are to teach the people of Israel the statutes of the Lord that he has spoken to by Moses. So, and it's from this that we get the idea that there are some of these laws that we see in here which are to teach the people what it means to be holy. Now holy is a term that we still use in the New Testament. It's a term that's referred to of God. Often God is referred to as God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. When the angels are surrounding God, they describe him as holy, holy, holy. And it's a word that we don't really use in modern language, and so we don't really understand what it means. The root basic definition of holy means to be set apart, to be other than, to be different and unique, to be special. To illustrate this, I would, back in the day, I would describe this with baseball cards. You know, kids used to grow up collecting baseball cards. If you got a pack of baseball cards, you'd sort through them to find the one that was special. And maybe it was a rookie card of somebody who you thought was going to be great. That card didn't get messed up. It went into a case. It was preserved. In modern days, some of the things we use that are holy are, we have shoes that I would consider to be holy. In other words, you don't wear those shoes out to do the yard with. Especially if you have boys, young boys, you have to teach them that some shoes should be holy. They should be set apart for specific purposes. There are shoes that maybe you just bought them for school. You don't expect them to be outside playing in them. But eventually they do because they don't keep those shoes holy. And so what happens? Those shoes are no longer pristine and nice. Maybe there are shoes that you have that you bought them for a special occasion to go to church or something with, or to a wedding maybe. And if they go outside and play basketball or football in those shoes, they won't be able to be used for that set apart purpose. So there are shoes you keep in your closet set apart just for this purpose. And maybe in your house, dad has a lot of things that are set apart just for him to use. Or maybe in the kitchen, mom has some things that are set apart that you don't get into and you don't mess with. Like I made the mistake one time of measuring out some Roundup with a kitchen measuring cup because I needed a measuring cup. I found out, no, those are to be separated. And so this is where the idea of clean and unclean comes from. So just in the same way that somebody for some reason didn't like me measuring out Roundup with baking utensils because that somehow made them unclean. And literally, it didn't matter what you did to clean them, lawn poison was never coming back into the kitchen. It was forbidden. And in the same way, there's a lot of these ceremonial laws that will denounce something as unclean. And the whole purpose of the concept of unclean and clean, as it's being taught throughout the book of Leviticus especially, is to try to help people see the world in terms of the holy, the separate, the other than, and the common. And God wanted them to be a holy people set apart for them, that they would be a kingdom of priests, that the entire nation would be a people that'd be set apart and holy unto the Lord. And holiness is a hard standard. To keep something clean and pure and perfect is very difficult. That's why in the kitchen you're watching things so much, is because things are often becoming unclean. And so in order to be able to use them for the purpose of baking, so to be pure enough and clean enough for you to use for the preparation of food, we have to clean them up very well. And so a lot of these Old Testament laws are all about understanding the concept of holiness and cleanliness and being set apart. Now, to understand whether or not or how much those apply today, let's fast forward back over to the New Testament and see what Jesus says in reference to the things of cleanliness. Now, once you understand the concept of cleanliness from the Old Testament, he can then say this over in Mark chapter 7 when he talks about cleanliness. He says, it's not what goes into your body that defiles you, because in the Old Testament, it's all about don't do this, it will defile you. Don't do this, it makes you unclean. Don't do this, it makes you unclean. Jesus is trying to explain, now that you have the concept of clean and unclean, let me lay out the reality of it. It's not what goes into you that defiles you. Rather, you're defiled by what comes out of your heart. From within in a person, and out of their heart comes evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, wickedness, deceitful, lust, desires, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these vile things come from within. That's what defiles you. Now, if you remember last week, we talked about how whenever an evil act is committed, there's typically two consequences of it. There's the vandalism of the evil, that which is taken, that which is stolen, but there's also the violation of the evil. And the violation deals with how the environment has changed, how the mindset of the people has changed, how there's a different feel or vibe because of that evil action. And what God is trying to explain to the people is that the entire world and community which you live in is full of evil. And it's evil in the environment, so much so that you're so immersed in it that it's become a part of your own very nature, that all of these things lie within you. And so uncleanliness in the area, or the uncleanliness in their community that he describes as, don't do this, don't do this, be careful of this. People got to realize that it is nearly impossible to go through just one day keeping yourself perfectly ceremonially clean. And God's like, yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to communicate to you. It is nearly impossible for you to go through a day without sinning. Why? Because everything in your environment makes you unclean. Because everything around you pushes you towards an unclean thought, as we later see that the purpose of understanding this Old Testament law to be. The whole concept is that you might realize that you live in an unclean world. That's why when God comes to Isaiah, in Isaiah chapter 6, he says, woe is me, I'm an unclean man, I've got unclean lips, I live among unclean people. See, Isaiah gets it. He understands the concept of cleanliness and uncleanliness and how he in his own life is not holy. And he's standing there before God himself, who has angels surrounding him, talking about how God is holy, 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 is the Lord God Almighty. And he just looks up and he says, I am unclean. Isaiah never would have had that understanding if it wasn't for the Old Testament laws of understanding what it means to be clean versus unclean, the holy versus the common. And so out of that, we begin to understand this concept of holiness and cleanliness before God, that God is holy and we are not. Now, when you get, once again, back over in the New Testament, Hebrews then explains and talks about this cleanliness. So what does that mean for us Christians? I mean, do we need to follow all of the Old Testament cleanliness laws or ceremonial laws in order for us to be holy before God or clean before God? No. That's where you see over in Hebrews chapter 9, verse 13, it says, remember we talked about this last week, it is by the blood of Christ that cleanses our consciences from the dead works so that we can serve the true and living God. Now, notice here he talks about how the blood, which we looked at this last week, was symbolic of life, that brings life back into the dead world. This blood would symbolically cleanse that which was unclean and make it holy once again in a spiritual sort of sense. And so because Christ died on the cross, as we symbolize through communion every week by taking of the cup which represents his blood, it's a picture that God has cleansed us, made us holy unto him because of what Jesus Christ has done. That's why also when you go over to the book of Acts, Paul's looking down at Peter and he says, Peter, there is no such thing anymore as an unclean animal. That is all gone. All those ceremonial laws from the Old Testament that talked about clean and unclean, now that you understand what holiness is, you don't need to follow all of those guidelines. So every hunter's favorite verse comes out of Acts chapter 10, verse 13, and a voice told him, get up, Peter, kill and eat. It's fall, and it's hunting season's coming on, and I'm beginning to hear that verse come alive to me right now. But he goes on to say, don't call anything impure or unclean that I have made clean. In other words, because of what Jesus Christ has done on the cross, he has made all things clean. He has made you holy to be able to enter into his presence because of what Jesus has done. His death on the cross, his blood that was shed has covered you and made all things clean before God for those who have a relationship with Jesus. Because now we have an understanding and a concept of that which is holy and that which is unholy. And I have a concept of that which is not to be used for Roundup out in the yard. So moving on, we have the ceremonial laws. Another category of laws we see in the Old Testament is a group that are often referred to as civil laws. Now keep in mind, Israel at this point in time was a theocracy. In other words, there was no separation between church and state. That the religious code was played out into civil society. And in any civil society, you have to have laws that are governing the people, right? And a part of the laws that are governing the people, there are laws that we have in America that you don't have in other countries because it's a different culture, it's a different place. There are laws that were on the books a couple hundred years ago that we laugh at now because they're just not relevant anymore. They're taken off the books quite often. And so in other words, you have laws in the Old Testament that refer to how to plow a field. For instance, in Leviticus 19 and over in Deuteronomy 22, there's a series of commandments about not mixing two different kinds of things. And one of them is don't put an ox and a donkey on the same plow. Because if you do that, it's a stress on the animals and it's not very productive. So just don't do it. But there's a principle at work here. And what you see over the New Testament is this Old Testament civil law. There was a principle behind that civil law that is then applied to a different context over in the New Testament. And maybe some of you know where I'm going here. When you have an ox and a donkey on the same plow, they are yoked together, and they are not equal in their power or strength or temperament. And so Paul takes this idea of unequally yoked, and he applies it to Christian relationships, marriage, business partnerships, etc. And he says, do not be unequally yoked. This is 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14. He says, do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. For what partnership does righteousness and lawlessness have together? And so he's taking the principle of the civil law, and he's applying it to a modern context for people in the New Testament. And so, like for us right now, I don't think that you look into the Old Testament and say, well, let's see, the principle of not mixing an ox with a donkey, unequally yoked, having two different kinds of things, plowing the same field. I can't have a John Deere and a Kubota in the same field. That's not what he's saying. Rather, there's a principle there of two things that can't go together, two things that don't work well together. There's a prohibition against putting different kinds of fabrics together. Well, we now know, by the way, that if you put two different kinds of fabrics together and you don't know what you're doing, what'll happen is that one might shrink in the wash and the other one won't. And when one shrinks in the wash and the other one doesn't, it tears it apart and messes it up. And so some of these guidelines are about the practicality of life. Other ones you find in there are about administering justice fairly. So for instance, there it talks about what to do if somebody kills somebody else. Well, there's a different punishment for somebody who commits what we would call first-degree murder, and for the punishment for what somebody would commit as we would call third-degree murder or manslaughter or accidental death. And so it has a different punishment for each of those. And so we see that there's a principle here that we can pull out of their civil law and say, okay, the penalty for one should be different from the penalty for the other. We looked last week about the concept of an eye for an eye and a tooth for tooth. That was all about making sure that when you go to reconcile a wrong in court, that it's just and it's fair, that it's commensurate or proportionate with what was done. That if somebody were to steal one sheep, that doesn't give them the right to slaughter the other person's entire herd. Rather, they need to replace that sheep that was stolen. They need to sort of compensate that person. Or sometimes you'll see where they need to give back a sheep and maybe one or two extra to sort of compensate for the loss and the hassle and everything else, and also to have a little bit of a punitive penalty for what was done. And so you see that the civil law in there is to govern their affairs. And from those civil laws, we pull out of them principles that apply to our modern context, principles that we need to follow when we make up our own civil laws. And a lot of our own modern civil laws are based on the concepts that we see out of the Old Testament civil laws. Jesus goes through a lot of these civil laws, and he gives us sort of a new understanding of them. It's all in Matthew chapter 5 especially. He goes through and he says, you've heard it said of old, or you've read from the scriptures that eye for an eye or tooth for tooth. Well, he puts all of that within the context of the new law that Jesus has given us. And hopefully we'll be talking about this a little bit more next week in a little bit more detail. Matthew 22:40 says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. Love your neighbors, you love yourself. All of the Old Testament laws, all 613 of them, hang on this. Or another version say, all 613 of those laws can be summed up with these two. In other words, the root principle behind all of the ceremonial laws, all of the civil laws, every law from the Old Testament, the root principle was about love, that you would love, that you have a love for God and a love for one another. In John 13:34, another way that the new covenant makes the old covenant obsolete is where he says, a new commandment I'm now giving you. This is the new commandment I want you to have. Love one another just as I have loved you. And so we have this new commandment of love, which will make the old obsolete. And here's what I mean by this. Picture this. When you have kids, let's just say you've got more than one kid in the house, and they're fighting, they're doing something wrong, and one of your children takes something from his brother or sister, hits them on the head, and calls them a name. What do you do? Now, what you do is you come in typically, and you'll say something about you need to give that back. In other words, you need to make restitution for what you did. You need to give that back. You need to apologize, say you're sorry. You need to give them a hug, and then sometimes you might, if somebody says something bad, maybe some of your rules in your house is, and to make up for the bad thing that you said, you need to say something you love about them. So we have to give it back, we have to say we're sorry, we have to give them a hug, and we have to say something nice about them. That's the rule that you may have laid down in your house for when they've done something like that. Well, as they grow up a little bit older and they do something, oftentimes you'll just look and say, hey, you need to apologize. Now, You didn't spell out that they need to say, I'm sorry, they need to give a hug, they need to say something positive, and they need to give it back. You didn't spell it out. You just said, you need to apologize. Now, many years later, perhaps they're grown children, and there's a conflict that breaks out, and you're having a phone call conversation, and you just say, you know, I just wish you'd love your brother. I just wish you'd love your brother. And sometimes that's all that needs to be said. And with your own mind, because the law of love, what would that dictate that you would do? Well, it would dictate that you would probably call them up and you would apologize for what you had done. You'd give back what they've, you know, what they've taken from you. You'd reconcile their relationship as far as, you know, the hugging part. You know, it's symbolizing that, you know, okay, you know, we're friends again. And maybe you might correct what it is that you said negatively about them. You would do all those things just instinctively because you're being motivated now and guided by love. And so hopefully by the time you get in your 20s, 30s, your mom doesn't need to say, your dad doesn't need to say to you, go say you're sorry. They don't need to spell all those things out. Why? Because the law of love has sort of trumped all of that or made all of those things obsolete or ridiculous to go through. And so a lot of what you find in the Old Testament, there's just no need for that sort of step-by-step, do this, do this, do this. That's why over in Galatians chapter 3, now by the way, the Galatian church, they struggled with all this. I mean, it's almost like as if that guy AJ that we watched in the opening clip was leading the Galatian church. It was somebody who thought that we had to follow all the Old Testament laws, everybody had to do them in order to be a good Christian. And Paul comes back to these churches that he started, and he's like, no, you guys are crazy. Who told you to do all this stuff? AJ? I mean, who told you to do all this ridiculous stuff? It's a loon. And then he says, you know, the purpose of the law was simply to be a tutor, to sort of give you a guide in the same way that you give baby steps to babies and you give child one, two, easy one, two, threes to little kids. That's what the law did. It sort of spelled everything out that if you were to love one another, this is what you would do. Or these are some kind of things that I'm going to have you do because those are the kind of things that you would do lovingly. Now, if you remove the love out of it, it just becomes this burden. And for many people, that's what happened with the Old Testament. They took the loving relationship with God out of it. They took a love for one another out of it. And it just became a burden of all these things that they have to do. And that's exactly what you've seen your kids do. You need to go apologize. Sorry. I love you. I think you're really skilled at soccer. I don't think that's what mom and dad's heart was, right? It wasn't. Your heart was that they would love one another again. And so what you see, the way people applied the Old Testament law, it was no different than your five-year-old with his forced apology because the law of the house has dictated it. And God looks forward to a day and a time where he says, someday it's going to be obsolete where I tell you how to do this. Someday there's going to be a day and a time where you just know the right thing to do. What he says in Jeremiah 31 is that my law will be written on your heart. So if you go back in Hebrews chapter 8 and you go back up there, he's quoting all of Jeremiah 31 where he says, my vision is that someday there'll be a day that comes where my law is written on your heart. Where you will have the same mind that I have for one another, that in your heart and in your mind, you will know the right thing to do, that it won't be something you do because I'm telling you to do it, it'll be something that you do simply because you're motivated out of the loving relationship that you and I have. And so that sort of gives us an understanding for these ceremonial laws and these civil laws and how they relate to modern day. There's principles throughout them, and I'm going to key on that little principle throughout them. The third category that's often used to describe Old Testament law is moral law. And this is typically a sort of a catch-all for everything that didn't fall in the first two categories of a civil law or a ceremonial law. There's this other group called moral law. Now, although there are some laws that are just strictly moral laws, like do not lie. I mean, there's a civil penalty for lying in the Old Testament as well. But do not lie is a moral law. And a moral law, by its very nature, it's timeless. It doesn't matter who you are, where you are, what culture you're come from. Lying is always wrong everywhere. It's not something you should do. Stealing, taking what is not yours, is always wrong. And so these are moral laws. Now, many of the civil laws and many of the ceremonial laws also had moral laws in them, or at the very least, moral law principles within them. And so that's why things like the bulk of the Ten Commandments, do not kill, do not commit adultery, do not steal, do not lie, do not covet, that's why those are so universal. That's why people who don't even believe in God, don't have any relationship or background in the church, they would often look to the Ten Commandments and say, oh, yeah, those are all good. I mean, how do you come up against the Ten Commandments and say, oh, yeah, I don't have any problem with killing, lying, stealing, adultery, coveting. I think those are all just, there's something within all of us that can sort of universally agree that's just not the right thing to do. Now, that doesn't mean that over time people haven't looked back at the moral laws of God and said, I don't agree. I think I'm going to make up my own moral code. And Romans talks about that. Romans chapter 1 talks about a people who would do that. And he summarizes up. He says, furthermore, they didn't think it was worthwhile. This is Romans chapter 1, verse 28 and following. He says, they didn't think it was worthwhile to retain knowledge of God. So God gave them over to depraved mind. In other words, they said, whatever God says was right and wrong, I think I'm going to do my own thing. Go back to Adam and Eve. This is the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and the day you eat of it, you'll be able to determine right from wrong. Adam and Eve said, I think I should be able to determine right from wrong. And it leads down this path. And even till now, this is why we don't like rules. We don't like somebody telling us what to do. And so Romans talks about what happens when you make up your own rules or you get rid of all of God's moral rules. He says, they didn't retain the knowledge of God, so God gave them over to a depraved mind so that they would do what ought not to be done. And they've become filled with every kind of wickedness and greed and evil and depravity. They're full of envy and murder and strife and deceit and malice. They're gossips, slanderers, God-haters, insolent, arrogant, boastful. They invent new ways of doing things wrong, and they disobey their parents. They have no understanding, no fidelity, no loyalty, no love, no mercy. And although they know God's righteous decree, although they know God's moral law, and that those who break God's moral law will face a penalty for it, a penalty of death, they not only continue to do these very things, they approve of everybody who practices them. So what does this look like in modern context? Well, back in the 60s, it was the hippie movement. And the hippies basically came along and said, we are not going to follow any moral code that was given to us by God or by government or civil laws, anything else. We don't want any ceremonial religious laws. We don't want any civil laws from the government. We are perfectly capable of governing ourselves and just doing what we want to do. And the question is, how did that work out? It didn't. The hippie communes all failed. I mean, Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco was an absolute failure. Why? Because eventually people realized they didn't like it when people broke moral laws. They didn't like it when somebody stole their stuff. They didn't like it when somebody slept with their wife. They didn't like it when people got killed. They didn't like those things. And so eventually they kind of came back around and says, no, I think there is some moral law that needs to be put in place. We've seen it in our own country just this very year. A group of people said, we don't need any civil or ceremonial laws. We can do our own thing. We will create a Capitol Hill autonomous zone because we don't like the way that law is being carried out in our nation, so we're going to do our own thing. And how long did that experiment take before it unraveled? A day? It was over before it began. And we're going to have, everything's going to be free. You know what happened? Homeless people came in and ate all their food. Then they said, we're starving now. We don't have anything. Oh, you didn't like it when somebody came in and took what you felt was yours? Interesting. We don't think that people should, that I think it's too brutal the way that people carry out the execution of a law. I'm not making any comment on that, but what did they do in Chaz? They were more brutal in the execution of their own made-up laws than anybody else has ever been. And it only took a few days before somebody was murdered in there before they said, this whole experiment isn't working at all. And that's exactly what happens whenever you abandon God's law. It leads to utter chaos. I mean, Chaz is better pronounced chaos than anything else. It was absolute chaos of lawlessness. So, to sort of understand, how do we, what of the Old Testament still applies? Simply this. The law that God has written on the hearts of all those who have a loving relationship with Him is the Old Testament laws that still apply. You take the principles out of the Old Testament that, speak to loving one another and loving God, that's what still applies. Something outside of that context or doesn't line up with that, Christ says, all of the law and the prophets hang on these. And if you can't figure out where that relates to loving one another and loving God, then you best figure out what the principle is before you just haphazardly try to apply it or insist somebody else applies that into somebody's life. There needs to be a shift in your thinking from, God, what are the limits of what I can do or what is allowed. That's law thinking. What's okay within law to what would love have me do? Because let's face it, even in our day and time, there are a lot of things that are legal, but we might call them immoral. There are a lot of things that we don't have a law in our country against, but are very unkind. And many of you have been taken to court and had somebody do something to you legally that was very unloving. Why? Because they asked the wrong question. They asked the question of, what are my legal limits and what is legally allowable, rather than, what does God really want from me? And so as you think through your own life right now to make an application of this, is the question is, am I cultivating the kind of relationship with God where I just want to make him happy? That I have a loving relationship with God where I don't need to be told this is right and this is wrong all the time. I can look to God and say, what is the loving thing to do here? In the same way that when you are in love with somebody, you don't need to be told what the loving thing is to do for that person quite often. Sometimes there's some helpful guidelines and some tips, which the Old Testament can give us some helpful guidelines and tips, like when it's been mandated, here's what was done. You know, when somebody loves somebody, here's typically the kind of things that they do. The question is where is your relationship with God? And that if you move to the point where God has written his law on your heart, where just out of love for God, you find yourself doing the right thing. And if you look at your life and you say, there's a lot of things I'm doing that aren't right, it's not a law that you need to look to. You need to go back and re-examine your relationship with God. And how is it that I can have a loving relationship with God that I'll enjoy for all eternity, but also will change how I see other people and how I see myself and how I see what is right and how I understand what is wrong? Would you want me to close out in prayer? Father, may we all someday get to the point, like David, who would say in Psalm 119, God, I love your law. I meditate on it day and night. For Father, it's within the law that we see how is it that we can best go about loving one another. How is it that we can share your kindness with one another? When Jesus was here, he was the full embodiment of everything that the law was. And he had this vision, this picture that as we become more like Jesus Christ, it will be a testimony to the entire world of a different way to live. We were called to be a city on the hill, a salt in a decaying and tasteless world. And Father, it's only when they see our good deeds that we shine like bright stars throughout the dark night, pointing people to relationship with you. So Father, may we must be so moved in our heart out of love for you that your law would truly be written on our hearts and in our mind. And in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.